This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. While in its planning stages, the U.S.-led war on Iraq drew criticism from U.S. lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle, as well as from Foreign Service representatives having to cope with fallout from the plans around the world. Three U.S. diplomats resigned in the process. Mary Wright, second-ranking at the U.S. Embassy Mongolia, told Secretary of State Colin Powell she was resigning because she could no longer perform her job in good conscience. John Brown, who joined the State Department in 1981, resigned on March 10th, saying Washington's Iraq policy was fomenting a rise in anti-U.S. sentiment around the world. But the first U.S. diplomatic resignation came in February with a strongly worded letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell from John Brady Kiesling, a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. Throughout his career, Kiesling served in U.S. embassies in Morocco, Armenia, Israel, and Greece. This weekend, he spoke with Mark Bibawa, co-host of the Arab Voices program on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. He spoke about the sentiments among the diplomatic community regarding the Bush administration's foreign policy and the likely effects of U.S. military occupation in Iraq.
Basically, it became clear to me that a series of policy choices the new administration had made had cut us loose from our traditional allies in Europe, but not only in Europe. We had alienated populations. We had made ordinary political cooperation much more difficult. And then when we decided to go to war with Iraq, we essentially cut ourselves loose from the ordinary standards of what the world would like to think of as international law and sort of decent international practice. It struck me that because the risks posed by Iraq were not as great as advertised, because the benefits from going in were certainly far less than advertised, because we were about to damage our much more important relationships around the world, it seemed to me that we were making a tragic mistake with the war in Iraq. And before that war took place, I hoped that my resignation could help be a catalyst for more effective resistance to that policy and to getting the foreign policy establishment to really reckon the costs and take another look at it.
You said in your resignation letter that until this administration, it had been possible to believe that by upholding the policies of my president, I was also upholding the interests of the American people and the world. I believe it no longer. Given your experience in the region, what do you think is the likely effect of a U.S. military occupation in Iraq?
The problem is that our presence is, for most of the people of the Middle East now, a catalyst for opposition. We may have the best intentions in the world, and in fact, we have a lot of good intentions, or very mixed intentions, I'm afraid, but it doesn't matter. We simply do not have the legitimacy in the region to achieve any of the things we want to achieve at any reasonable cost. So long as our troops are there, so long as we're willing to spend money, we can hold together something that will eventually be better than what Saddam had, but I have no faith in either our staying power, our ability, and I certainly have no faith that we can win any of the hearts and minds required to really change Iraq for the better.
What are the sentiments among the wider diplomatic community in your experience regarding this administration's foreign policy?
You mean within the U.S. Or within the
world? Within the exposure that you've had, which is pretty wide, can you give us an idea of how U.S. and foreign diplomats are reacting?
American diplomats keenly feel how difficult this thing is. They know how much opposition there is around the world. They've been trying their best as loyal servants of the president to persuade people and to at least minimize the damage from our policy. It's a wide range of views, and I can't characterize them, but they're faithfully carrying out their duty, most of them, but feeling that they're up against terrible odds. Internationally, I think that this consensus is that American policy has been taken over by a very dangerous populist ideological group that, for mostly domestic political reasons, is running a very dangerous foreign policy that risks destabilizing the planet.
And in the Iraq example specifically, given your academic background in ancient history and archaeology, What would have been the best course of action to have prevented the looting and destruction of Iraq's cultural artifacts, do you think?
Well, the best thing would have been not to have gone to war. If we were going to go to war, we had to do it with enough of the right kind of troops that we could immediately take control of the places of interest to us. And, you know, the bizarre thing is not only did we commit this cultural barbarism on, you know, on the history of the planet, we even failed to achieve elementary intelligence aims, such as seizing the archives of the foreign ministry and the Mukhabarat, the intelligence services. I mean, it was just an incredibly amateur operation, and Rumsfeld, who ran the thing personally, is in, you know, has seriously compromised U.S. interests by trying to do it on the cheap.
And what do you think of the response locally, you know, which has tended to be fairly anti-American? Do you think it's been reinforced by the fact that U.S. troops were able to protect the oil ministry and not the museum, for example?
That was a catastrophically stupid decision. And, of course, Iraqis are genuinely delighted to be rid of Saddam, and they want us to go away, either to go away or at least to establish order and convince them that things will be better than they were under Saddam, and we are not doing that.
Is there any significance to the dates that you chose to submit your resignation?
Not really. In basically, my decision to resign came when it became absolutely clear to me that we were going to war regardless, that nothing United Nations did could make any difference. And at that point, I decided that my career had essentially lost its meaning to me, that staying on was just unnecessary agony. And I wanted to resign far enough in advance of the start of the war that I would have at least a little bit of time to speak out before the war started. Because once the war started, the ability to make any impact, you know, essentially evaporated.
Yeah, I know you're speaking at Rice University tomorrow, but can you give us a rundown, maybe, of what are your thoughts on your plans for the future or the immediate future?
Well, the immediate future is more speaking. I'll be after Rice and UT on Tuesday. I'll be flying to Cyprus for a conference. It's an interesting conference on how to restore the dialogue of civilizations and cultures, try to find new ways to bridge the gaps between East and West, between Christianity and Islam, between Eastern and Western Christianity. It's an important thing to do. And the United States ought to be sort of the symbol of the success of bridging cultures. I mean, we are a multi-ethnic, multicultural society. We've got, you know, every race, religion, creed, color, sexual preference, anything you name, we have, and we can generally live together, but we have taken ourselves out of the marketplace of ideas because of these very short-sighted policies. And I'm trying to go there and say, no, the United States is still a model. You just have to look beyond the government, look to the philosophy, the values, and the people of the United States, who are still fundamentally, I think, a force for something positive.
Former U.S. Ambassador John Brady Kiesling, who resigned in February out of protests over the Bush administration's policy in Iraq. He was speaking with Mark Babawi at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Special thanks also to Renee Feltz for producing that piece. While trade sanctions controlled Iraq's oil exports during the 90s, an illegal oil trade flourished. On the border between Turkey and Iraq, for example, people managed to make a living by buying oil or diesel fuel very cheaply inside Iraq and selling it to consumers in Turkey. But war and instability have tightened up security on the border, and most of the smugglers are now unable to do business. Pratap Chatterjee went to the border recently to talk to some of the lorry drivers and hear why communities on both sides of the border need to be able to trade.
On the old Silk Road in Turkey, once traveled by merchants in Asia to markets in Europe, an illegal trade in oil smuggling has flourished for the last 10 years. It was prompted by United Nations sanctions against the regime of Saddam Hussein, restricting the quantity of oil that could be exported from Iraq. The truckers smuggled as much as 150,000 tons of diesel a month across the narrow bridge to the Turkish border post of Habur for the last decade. Ahmet Can is a Kurdish trucker from Mardin in southeastern Turkey who made a living for the last 5 years buying diesel in northern Iraq and bringing it back across the border.
Zaten şu an için tanker üzeri çalışıyor kapı. Fiber depoları bırakmıyorlar. Fiber depoyu bir ara bıraktılar tipik.
The border crossing officials no longer allow the oil trucks through. In the past, they worked with the mafia to establish a Turkish petrol office to buy cheap oil and sell it more expensively. Whoever had a house, land, or animal to sell sold it to buy an old truck which they used to drive across the border every month or so. Now it is not allowed, and we truckers cannot make a living out of it. There are many stranded over this side. Our truck used to bring enough money to support 3 households.
A total of 50,000 trucks used to make this border crossing on a regular basis. But in 2002, the Turkish government cracked down on the trade because they feared that the money was funding the movement for autonomy for the Kurdish minority on the border. Mehmet is a trucker from Gaziantep who has been driving across the border for the last 10 years.
Normally the trip takes 2 days, but sometimes we wait for 15 days to cross the border because of the war with America. The border guards make our life very difficult. We don't have proper papers. In fact, we are working illegally so the police can stop us. But we have no choice because there are no other jobs. We make just $35 a month. We have no money for food, and we cannot see our families for weeks at a time.
Abdul Kadir Kilij is another driver who has also just returned from Iraq, where he sold electric pipes and soft drinks. Unlike the other drivers, he has only been crossing the border for 1 year. He says that even though the truckers from Turkey are very poor, the people on the other side are even poorer.
I was very surprised when I first went to northern Iraq. They are really very poor. They cannot even get food to eat. It's really heartbreaking. I think it would be better if the gate was opened so that they could trade with us.
War, on the other hand, they say will make people on both sides of the border suffer even more. Recep Yilmaz, a trucker from Ankara, says that the value of the Iraqi money he got paid for his cargo of consumer goods has dwindled in value over the last 15 years that he has been doing business in this border region.
This is Saddam's money. In 1986, this money was equal to $750. But now you cannot even buy a single meal with this money on the other side of the border. It is only worth 2,500 Turkish lira. In the 1980s, we could cross the border and pay for our whole trip with this money. All our accommodation, our food, everything. But now this money won't even buy a single Coca-Cola.
Unless peace returns to the region, the truckers say life will only get harder for Kurds on both sides of the border.
Prithap Chatterjee reporting from Turkey. As we hear daily celebrations on television of the supposed liberation of Iraq, we turn to Vernon Belcourt, Director of International Affairs for the American Indian Movement, Grand Governing Council. As a Native American, Belcourt, also known by his Indian name, Waba Nanini, shares his unique perspective about the liberation of America from the natives several centuries ago.
Welcome to America, the free enterprise system, which means free land, free labor, and free resources, and if you don't give it to us, we will take it through the use of force and violence and America's weapons of mass destruction. My name is Waba Nanini, and I represent the American Indian Movement. It's an honor again to stand with America's true patriots, patriots for peace, love, and justice. Standing by the thousands across what is called America. With the fall of the Third Reich of Nazi Germany, there were war crimes tribunals called the Nuremberg tribunals. German military officers, political leaders, and the German people were protesting that they were innocent because, one, they were only following orders. The German people pled ignorance and said we did not know what was going on in those concentration camps. Justice Robert Jackson was the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg. He was a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. In response to his protest, he said, if certain acts and violations of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether Germany commits them or whether the United States commits them. We are not prepared to impose a code of criminal conduct against others that we would not be willing to have invoked against us. I believe we must hold the Fourth Reich under George Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Myers, Franks, and all the other warmongers in this unelected government responsible for high crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. They expect the Iraqi people to be grateful because the American forces are liberating Iraq. I want to take this opportunity to thank America and the American war criminals, America's so-called founding fathers, for liberating our country and wiping out 16 million of us and since the Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock. We want to thank them for the smallpox. You see, we're already immunized thanks to the Americans of that era. I want to thank them for the massacres. I want to thank them for wiping out 150,000 of our Mayan people in the country of Guatemala. I want to thank the Bush administration for bushwhacking our democratic process, for bushwhacking the U.S. Constitution, and I want to thank them for the terrible crimes against humanity that they are perpetuating against the people of Iraq. And we must hold them responsible for these crimes against humanity. We must implement the real American Revolution at the ballot box and vote out these Republican and Democratic warmongers who are disgracing us throughout the world, Republican and Democrat alike. The American media is not only embedded with the troops in Iraq, but they are embedded with George Bush and this war machine here that possess the so-called White House. And what is it for? It's for oil. We all know that. It's been said many, many times. And it's one of the greatest crimes against humanity. Finally, I don't want to hear any more speakers refer to America's weapons of mass destruction as Black Hawk, Apache, Comanche, or Tomahawk missiles. Refer to them from now on as Reagan helicopter gunships, Bush helicopter gunships. And finally, I want you to go to the Guatemala Human Rights Commission. Their report of the Historical Clarification Commission, which spells out the role of American corporate interests, George Bush the First, as President of the United States and head of the CIA, has wiped out 150,000 Indian people alone in Guatemala. You see, the American war continues here, and it continues against free people throughout the world. Free Leonard Peltier, free all political prisoners. Miigwech, thank you very much.
Vernon Belcourt, Director of International Affairs for the American Indian Movement's Grand Governing Council, speaking at a recent anti-war rally here in the nation's capital, organized by the activist group Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. Thanks to Dan Malakoff from the D.C. Radio Co-op and Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer at Pacifica Station WPFW, for preparing that segment. As recording artists such as the Dixie Chicks and Madonna fall to the pressures of corporate America and public opinion, there are those that speak truth to power when it is most important. Ricky Lee Jones has blessed America and the world for over three decades with her unique storytelling music. Currently, she has focused her music on inspiring people to stand up and speak the truth. With a new song entitled Ugly Man, which has been a creation out of the current crusades of America, Ricky Lee Jones is still making music out of love for the people. She spoke recently to KPFK host Michael Slate.
This is called The Ugly Man. It was inspired a lot by listening to seditious beats. Did I say that right?
Seditious.
Yeah. Seditious. What does seditious mean? Sedition, seditious beats. What is a seditious beat?
It's like a traitorous beat, a treasonous beat.
Okay. Good, because that's how I didn't feel like a traitor, actually, but I felt very, but anyway, there's so much discussion about, on this radio show, so much great jazz and discussion about Bush, and I knew I wanted to use music to be a part of that community of people against, you know, what was going on. And so The Ugly Man is a simple lyric. It could be about any ugly man, but it is particularly about George W. Bush.
He's an ugly man. He always was an ugly man. He grew up to be like his father. Ugly man, and he'll tell you lies. Look at you and tell you lies. Grew up to be like his father, ugly inside.
Heard The Ugly Man. I don't know how or why, but it began to be fed and inspired by this picture I have of the Panthers, of the Black Panthers back then. And so anyway, you know, I'm not good at repeating what I said. I was telling you all about it, but there's something about that time and what they wanted to accomplish to bring the whole level of humanity, but especially this concentrated group of people that were living in dire straits, to empower them, make us noble and fight the system no matter what it took. And something about that is feeding me 25 years later, and that's a lot of what's in that song.
Actually, did I articulate that time? You did pretty good. You know, I liked the point that you made earlier about that when you hear this musical spot, you'll see all the Panthers standing around.
When you hear the horns, yeah, then they all walk into the room. You'll see them there.
Right. They're there. Beautiful.
And so your point about, you know, responsibility. Well, for my career, I was adamantly against getting involved politically. I felt that my job is to feed people's spirit, not to encumber the process with my point of view politically. But in the last 2 years, what's happened has been so ghastly. I couldn't help but not write about it on the website. And as I went to write, I didn't write about this on purpose. The powerful music that came from me was about this. This is what's happening. This is what matters. This is what there is to say. And so it's not, I don't do it because I'm obliged to do it. I do it because that's all I can do. It's all that's coming from me. Well, it's not all. I'm also still writing about lonely children, but this is what, you know, matters. So.
Well, it's really important because, you know, there's a whole thing that's going on now where, you know, the question, I mean, there are these bullies out there saying that, saying things like, well, you can't, an artist, who are you? You're an artist. You
right.
can't speak up.
As if somehow, if we're musicians, we have less of a right to say what we think than someone else. I think the most important thing is that you say it everywhere you go, because they're frightening people. They're equating, they're doing a very Hitler thing. Hitler had this thing where he went, love God, love Germany, love Germany, love Hitler. Well, that's the same thing that's going on now. If you say you don't like George Bush, they say you're anti-patriotic. I don't care if you're patriotic or not. They don't have any right to equate goodness with patriotism or goodness with liking George Bush. And I think everywhere you go, you've got to say, I am against George Bush. I am against the war. And say it out loud, because here was my story I wanted to tell you. I have these no war signs in my yard. I live at a really important intersection, so it's real visible. Every day I come home, people have torn my signs down. One day, tore it down three times in the same day. If anybody has any no war signs, send them over here so I can put them up in my yard. But today, I got a letter from, well, I got one cranky letter, but I got a letter from a lady, you can tell she was an elderly lady, said, I drive by your house every day and I just want to tell you how courageous I think you are to have your signs up now that the war started and it matters a lot to me. So again, this weekend, my sign's down. I go out, I come back, and there's another sign there. Somebody has brought a wooden sign, painted it white, and written "No War" by hand, and put it in my yard.
Great. That's great.
So I thought, people are scared, and they want to speak out, and they see people tearing down my signs, and so you think nobody agrees with you, but actually they do, and they just need to be encouraged. Not just, but they need to be encouraged to speak out and to vote. I wanted to say that one thing about the music was that it, you know, I have great teachers, from Marvin Gaye writing Inner City Blues, and Freddie's Dead, and the great music of that time that was remarking on the culture and trying to change it. And that's what I use as my map.
That was singer-songwriter Ricky Lee Jones speaking with KPFK host Michael Slate. This segment was produced and edited for Peace Watch by Fidel Rodriguez and Christine Blonsdale. To find out more about Ricky Lee Jones, you can visit her website at www.rickyleejones.com. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer this evening was T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adil Hamid of KPFA, Reem Kathuda, and OneWorldRadio.net. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So please pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.